Hello, and welcome to the Science Podcast for June 6, 2008. I'm Robert Frederick. This week, highly impulsive behavior predicts the switch from experimental drug use to becoming an addict. Student veterans pursuing science degrees, how the climate-driven effects on marine life have been overlooked, and insights into the ancient Indus civilization. All this, plus our usual roundup of stories from our free online daily news site, Science Now.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the Science Society, publishers of Science Magazine, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. The American Association for the Advancement of Science at www.aaas.org.
You might casually say you're addicted to chocolate, but being addicted to cocaine suggests something far more serious, that the addiction is compulsive, meaning a cocaine addict takes cocaine despite harmful consequences. In a paper in this week's Science, Barry Everett and colleagues report that such compulsive drug use in rats may be predicted by whether the rats are highly impulsive. The research supports observations in humans that suggest that highly impulsive people are overrepresented in drug-addicted populations, and the research may provide some insight into the neural mechanisms of drug addiction. I spoke with Everett from his office at the University of Cambridge.
We have been trying to study in an animal model what it means to be vulnerable to develop drug addiction. And we've investigated a particular potential vulnerability characteristic, which is that of impulsivity. And by impulsivity, we mean being able to wait for a predictive stimulus that tells you where to respond, or indeed wait for a reward, or a larger over a smaller reward. And we discovered that animals, rats in our colony, spontaneously exhibit an impulsivity trait. It's a small proportion of them, 10% or so. And what we've shown is that if you give these animals the opportunity to self-administer cocaine, that group are a group that end up as compulsive drug takers. They take more drug than non-impulsive animals. They take that drug despite adverse environmental consequences, and they show other behavioral characteristics of addiction.
Now, did your team only look at impulsivity as a predictor for addiction-like behavior?
No, we also looked at animals that show high locomotor responses to novelty. And the reason we studied those is because there's been a suggestion for some 15 or 16 years now that animals that show spontaneously high responses to novelty are more likely to self-administer stimulant drugs like cocaine. But we weren't sure whether a greater tendency to self-administer drugs, to learn how to do that, was in any way related to the propensity later on to lose control over that drug intake and to self-administer drugs compulsively. And so we compared those two phenotypes. And if you like, the novelty-seeking animals, they could be thought of as providing a model of sensation-seeking. And of course, in the human literature, in the clinical literature, addicts are often described as being either impulsive or sensation-seeking or both. And so we looked at the way in which those behavioral characteristics operationalized in rats related to cocaine self-administration and eventually compulsive drug taking.
And so what criteria does a rat have to meet in order to be considered addicted?
Well, it's conceptually difficult to actually get to the state of describing an animal as addicted rather than just having taken drugs. So the way we've operationalized this is to say, to take one characteristic from the diagnostic manual of addiction, or substance dependence as it's called in the United States, which is persisting in seeking and taking drugs despite adverse or aversive consequences, which in humans could be a variety of forms: losing friends, losing family, losing a job, losing money, losing health. And despite knowing those outcomes, individuals still persist in taking drugs. So we've modeled this in rats by, when they've had a long-term exposure to the drugs, seeing whether they will continue to work in the environment to make responses, even though sometimes those responses result in mild punishment. What we use as a mild punishment is a mild electric foot shock to the feet, which is certainly not high enough to stop them doing anything because they still respond for drugs, but is an aversive outcome to their drug-taking responses where none was there before.
And that's the shift to this compulsive behavior when it's irresistible and against one's best interests.
Exactly. Exactly. So that's what we've tried to model. And we think that captures actually elements of that characteristic in human addicts. And we used a couple of other measures. They were developed by David Belin, who's the lead author. But the one we think really captures the notion of compulsive drug taking is this persistence of the behavior in the face of adverse or aversive outcomes.
Does this behavioral observation shed light on what's happening neurologically with impulsivity leading to compulsivity?
Well, not yet. That's where we're going now, trying to understand what the neural basis of compulsivity is. But we do know a very interesting fact about these impulsive animals, which came from a study that was published about a year ago in Science. And the lead author there was Jeff Daly. And in that study, we made the observation initially that these impulsive animals escalated their cocaine intake much more rapidly. By escalating, I mean in a unit time, they take almost twice as much drug as non-impulsive animals. And that impulsive animals, again, long before they'd started to self-administer cocaine, have very low levels of a particular type of dopamine receptor in a part of the basal forebrain called the nucleus accumbens, which has long been known to be important for the effects of addictive drugs. And their impulsivity is correlated with the level of those receptors. And that actually predicts the tendency to escalate cocaine intake. And it now can be seen as a predictor of eventual transitions to or switches to addiction or compulsive drug seeking. I think the issue with human addiction is that it's often said that those individuals who are addicted are impulsive or sensation seeking, but it's never been clear, I think, until this study, whether that impulsivity and sensation seeking is a cause or a consequence of their chronic drug taking. And of course, the big issue with clinical studies of addiction is your starting point, by and large, is individuals who are addicted. So it's very difficult to look back in time and ask the question about their behavior before they started taking drugs. And I think a key advance is in this study is we can now see that individuals who can be described as impulsive or sensation-seeking when they're in the addicted state may have had that characteristic before they started taking drugs. So it may actually be a part of the causal mechanism in their propensity to develop addiction.
Well, Barry Everett, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Barry Everett is senior author of a paper on the switch to compulsive cocaine taking. Read the paper in this week's Science.
Getting a science or engineering degree comes with a few battles. But for some students, their path has included time on actual battlefields.
Science Careers Managing Editor Alan Kotok with a special feature on veterans in science.
Veterans face unique challenges in returning to school. In addition to having spent semesters away from coursework and research, they return with emotional scars of combat.
I came back and my first semester was extremely hard. I had low motivation.
Jeremiah Peterson is getting a bachelor's degree in chemistry next year from University of Minnesota in Minneapolis. He joined the Minnesota National Guard after high school. His unit was deployed to Iraq in 2004-2005 during his second year at the university.
You know, it's hard to find the importance of sitting down and studying when, you know, you come from a place where what's really important is when your life's on the line.
Peterson exemplifies one of the biggest adjustments student veterans need to make, leaving the tight military units of teamwork and cooperation to civilian academic culture, where students are very much on their own.
I'd gone to school for 2 years, and I came back 2 years later, and all my friends had graduated. I no longer had the friends, the classes that I could ask questions if I felt dumb. Soldiers come from this very close-knit, you know, platoon of people who always have the back to alone by themselves on a campus full of people.
The stress of being in school is very different from that of being in the military. And now, because of rapid air travel, veterans no longer have the time to adjust from the intensity of the combat zone to that of school. Brian, who prefers not to use his real name, says veterans used to have several weeks' long journey back home to make that adjustment.
Compared to now, when I left Iraq, I left one morning, spent the afternoon in Qatar, and then I was in the United States 14 hours later.
Brian is an Air Force reservist and PhD candidate in sociology. Since starting his graduate work in August 2002, Brian says his reserve unit has been activated 8 or 9 times, including to combat deployments.
And my out-processing as a reservist was basically making sure all my uniform, my equipment was all taken care of. At the time I was married and had kids, one of the checklist items was go to the family support system where I signed my name and I was given a booklet and a CD and told to come back if I had any questions. And as far as the emotional or psychological aspect, you know, that was about 7 minutes of my time.
Even if student veterans manage to handle the psychological adjustment from combat to classroom, there are other hurdles, particularly as some veterans continue their service in the reserves or National Guard. Anastasia Bodner is a PhD candidate in genetics at Iowa State University in Ames. She served in the Iowa National Guard in 2006-2007 after her active Army and Reserve duty.
So, you know, about a year, I was actively drilling every month with the Iowa National Guard and trying to pursue my graduate degree at the same time. I think that the hardest part was when they arranged the annual summer training during pollination season. And I'm working on corn, so I had to come and pollinate my experimental plot. Luckily, we had enough people in the lab that were able to pick up my slack. But I felt terrible that, you know, I had to depend on other people to take care of my plants, my experiments. And there was no way I could get out of it.
But despite the challenges student veterans face in returning to campus, Sarah Nyer says her military experience made her more determined. Nyer spent 3 years in the Army and will start a PhD program in mechanical engineering at Carnegie Mellon University this fall.
Before I was with the Army, I wasn't motivated as a career path. I wasn't sure what I wanted to do. And one of the reasons I joined the Army is because I wanted to go and experience the world right off the bat. After I came back, I was just so very driven. Now, before, I highly doubt that I would have been as motivated or as driven.
And John Maldivan says that determination can result from both one's military experience and the maturity that comes with it. Maldivan completed a master's degree in basic medical science after serving in the Air Force for 9 years, and next fall starts a PhD program in biomedical science at University of Michigan in Ann Arbor.
And I think with a military background or another profession that comes into go back to school, I think it's very true. You're just very focused on what you're doing. So schoolwork and interacting with your professors and administrative types to get through the program is a lot easier. And also, I think having been an instructor and having given a lot of presentations as a military officer, I think it really helped me when I had to do seminars and things like that, I guess.
With their experiences and determination, veterans provide a good example for anyone considering a return to school. In particular, there was no bitterness or complaint among the veterans I spoke with, even though their lives may have been disrupted more than they anticipated. 3 of them are even continuing their military service. And many of the students organized veterans groups on their campuses to help their fellow vets make the transition to civilian and academic life. If you have a chance, talk with student veterans. You'll really get a sense of how special they are. For Science Careers, this is Alan Kotok.
This week on Science Careers, you'll find Alan Kotok's interviews with these and other veterans, plus a story on a new GI Bill to fund tuition for veterans. Find them online at sciencecareers.org. While the oceans cover some 70% of our planet, our knowledge of land-based organisms far exceeds our understanding of marine life, particularly when it comes to understanding the effects of climate change. For example, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change reported more than 28,000 significant biological changes on land due to climate change, but less than 100 for marine and freshwater systems. In a policy forum in this week's Science, Anthony Richardson and Elvira Polachanska argue for development of a comprehensive understanding of how climate change affects life beneath the sea. I spoke with Polachanska, who works for the Climate Adaptations Flagship for the CSIRO in Australia.
We're gathering quite a good knowledge of impacts of climate change on terrestrial biological systems, but we know very little about what's happening in our oceans, even though our oceans cover 70% of the planet. We still have very little information on how climate change is affecting and will affect our marine life.
Did the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change not address it adequately?
No, they didn't. If you have a look at the global synthesis of biological impacts, you'll note that there's over 28,000 changes in terrestrial systems, but only 85 for marine and freshwater systems.
Do you think that might be because of the widespread view that the oceans are somehow buffered from climate change?
I think it's unlikely it's because of a view that the oceans are buffered from climate change. I think it's fairly well accepted now that climate change is impacting our oceans as well as our terrestrial systems. But there are additional problems to working in the oceans, which maybe have led to an underreporting from the oceans. For example, our forays onto the oceans are very brief. And it's very expensive to work in the oceans. You have to account for ship time and resources. So we're really not able to monitor changes in the oceans quite the same way we can monitor them on land.
Besides money, what else is needed to get at that missing information about how the oceans are impacted by climate change?
I think marine ecologists need to get more involved in the actual IPCC process. One of the things we've looked at is how many people with marine biological expertise were on the IPCC authorship for Chapter 1 of Working Group 2. And we found that overwhelmingly, expertise seemed to be terrestrial or cryosphere. There was very few marine people in them. And we think just by marine ecologists getting more involved in the IPCC process that we'd start to pick up sort of research and data series that have been overlooked.
Now, you're all ecologists. Is there some disconnect between marine and terrestrial ecologists?
Certainly there is. To make some very sort of general sweeping statements, marine and terrestrial ecologists tend to sit in different institutions. We publish in different journals. And some people have suggested that maybe there's this unequal distribution of science funding. However, I'm sure every single scientist in the world would claim that their research is underfunded.
I imagine so. Are there any particular approaches specifically for marine ecologists to take to overcome this disconnect?
Certainly. I think marine ecologists need to make more effort to be involved in the climate change research community. And we also need to take account into the way we report changes. If you're a researcher working with plankton, you tend to sort of think in functional groups and report changes in functional groups. And this might also lead to the underreporting. So we need to explicitly state changes as sort of kilometers per degree centigrade or days per degree centigrade.
So that you'll all be working from a common data set? Is that the idea?
The idea is maybe that we're all working from a common template that will make it easier to produce a global synthesis of what's happening in the oceans. I mean, the IPCC report has reviewed the available literature, but as you can imagine, the climate change impact literature is large. It's a big job to review this. And I think a lot of the reports from marine systems are hidden within the research papers. There may be these changes aren't being reported as the primary focus of research papers, which is fair enough. But unless you know the marine literature yourself very well, it's often difficult to identify these reports.
Now, I understand you went to the International Symposium on the Effects of Climate Change in the World's Oceans last month in Spain. How did you all address this topic there?
Through various means. I actually gave a presentation at the conference raising our concerns regarding the underreporting marine system. And I have to say that the response we had from other researchers in the room was extremely positive. This seemed to be a message that was resonating throughout the marine science community.
Elvira Polachanska, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Elvira Polachanska is senior author of a policy forum on how climate-driven effects on marine life have been overlooked. Read all about it in this week's Science. This has been a busy week for climate politics on Capitol Hill here in Washington, D.C. With a wrap-up, here's Science's deputy editor, Barbara Jasny.
On May 29th, the White House finally released its scientific assessment of the effects of global change on the United States. The assessment describes the current and potential impacts of climate change on public health, natural resources, and energy production. The report is required by law to be issued every 4 years. However, this is the first such report in the 7 years of the Bush administration. Also this week, a debate has been going on in the Senate over the most recent version of the Lieberman-Warner climate change bill. This bill maintains a cap-and-trade system for reducing greenhouse gases by 2050, cutting them to about a third of current emission levels. To mitigate concerns about the impact of such a cut on economic stability, the bill includes provisions that allow the president to adjust emissions targets if necessary to protect the economy. It also provides a variety of other financial measures to ease the transition for industry. But that hasn't stopped the White House from threatening to veto the legislation, arguing that it would be by far the single most expensive regulatory bill in our nation's history. This does not bode well for another climate change bill that Representative Edward Markey has proposed. His proposal is more stringent than the Senate bill.
That was Deputy Editor Barbara Jasny with a policy update from Science and the AAAS Center for Science, Technology, and Congress. Ancient Egyptians left behind pyramids. Mesopotamians? Spectacular tombs. The end of civilization? As far as archaeologists have been concerned, lots of bricks and really good plumbing. But as Science News writer Andrew Lawler reports, archaeologists now realize the Indus dwarfed their grand neighbors in many ways.
So unlike Egypt or Mesopotamia, people didn't know that the Indus River civilization even existed until the 1920s, when the first archaeological excavations happened in what is today's Pakistan. Now, at the time, it was British India. And in 1947, the partition happened, and that's when the British left and the subcontinent was divided between India and Pakistan. And when they drew that line right through the heartland of what had been the Indus River civilization. As a result, unlike Egypt and Mesopotamia and other parts of the world, the study of the Indus has been a little schizophrenic. You have people digging on the Pakistan side and on the India side. But rarely have the two really been able to get together and talk to each other. So as a result, there's a Cold War, essentially, between the two countries. So as you find in Central Asia and a few other places in the world, there's really not been an attempt to pull together a single view of what was the Indus, who were these people, and what do we know about them.
What's going on now that's made that view a little clearer?
Well, what's happened is there are a variety of things. One is the introduction of new technologies, which can allow us to, for example, pinpoint where certain rocks, stones that were used by the Indus people, where they actually came from, what kind of bones are there, and what people were eating, all kinds of pollen analysis about what the landscape was like. So there's a whole new array of techniques now available for archaeologists, which are now being applied in the Indus. That's one thing. The other thing is that in the 1990s, the BJP, the fundamentalist Hindu party, took over as the leading party in the government. And they have a very strong sense of India's past, and that includes the Indus. And for many people, from that point of view, the Indus was the first Hindu civilization, was the progenitor, was the beginner, the origin of Hindu civilization. And as a result, the government was very happy to provide money and support for archaeological excavation. So a lot was done in the 1990s and in the early part of this decade, looking at a variety of places in India that had never been explored.
What are some of the things that archaeologists have learned? Any treasures or tombs like in Egypt or ancient Mesopotamia?
No, unlike Egypt, Mesopotamia, it's a very different picture. It's very puzzling, and for a long time the Indus has been very enigmatic and obscure because it was so different. There are no mummies. There are no tombs filled with gold, but there had been some spectacular finds in the past decade or two. For example, just the fact that until recently we thought there were only two cities, that is Harappa in the north of today's Pakistan and Mohenjo-daro in the south of today's Pakistan. But now we know that there are at least five major cities, including Rakhigari, which is a huge site that's only been partially excavated in India, Dholavira in the Indian state of Gujarat, which is this fantastic site that shows a very planned city with high walls, citadels, and incredible water systems, as well as Gunwariwala, which is a huge site in Pakistan, just on the Pakistan side of the border, which is a large city that is yet to be fully excavated. In fact, excavations are just beginning this year.
Are archaeologists getting any sense of cultural knowledge of the Indus civilization, a writing system or something like that?
Well, one of the puzzles of the Indus is that it's different from every other major civilization that we know. There are no obvious temples. There are no obvious government buildings. And this is very, very strange. Of course, you have the pyramids and grand temple and palace complexes in places like Egypt, Mesopotamia. But in the Indus, the picture is much more different. But it's not as different as people thought. For a long time, people thought, well, it was a very egalitarian society. You didn't have elites that forced people to build large monumental structures. Well, now it looks like that's not quite true. There actually are quite a few monumental structures in many of these Indus cities. And so it gives us a picture of a society that, while we don't know much now about the religion or the politics, we're starting to get a picture of a society that has a lot of technology and that uses that technology more for public works projects than for great monumental structures that are designed to glorify a single leader.
Any system of writing going on?
Yes, the Indus has a set of symbols that were first found in the 1920s. And since the 1920s, scholars have been trying desperately to try and understand what these symbols mean. And, of course, it has been assumed that it's a script, that is a form of writing. But up until now, at least, there have been no successful attempts to decipher this script. In fact, some scholars recently proposed that, in fact, it's not a script. In fact, it's a series of symbols, such as the cross is a symbol for Christians, or the crescent a symbol for Muslims, that, in fact, it's a symbolic system but not an actual form of writing. Part of the reason for this is that there are very few lengthy inscriptions that have been found. Most of them are fairly short, half dozen or so, signed instead of lengthier inscriptions that you would find, say, in Mesopotamia or Egypt. So that's a very hot debate right now, whether this is a script. And then, of course, the question remains, what does it mean?
Are any archaeologists out there looking for the equivalent of the Rosetta Stone that helped them translate Egyptian writing?
Well, it would be nice, and it's certainly possible because the Indus was not an isolated backwater in Asia. It was, in fact, not only an important civilization, but it was very connected to Mesopotamia in terms of trade. There's a lot of trade going, and that's one of the more exciting finds of the past decade, is that, in fact, the Indus were very aggressive traders. They were definitely playing a very large role in what was the first attempt by humanity to create a kind of globalization network of trading that spanned thousands of miles. You had traders that clearly were leaving the Indus area in today's Pakistan and India, traveling across the Arabian Sea and up the Persian Gulf and trading directly with Mesopotamians. In fact, there are some Mesopotamian writings that we can read which talk about people from Malua, which these days scholars have accepted the idea that this, in fact, is a reference to the Indus.
I would imagine that would mean there would be far more than just the five city sites that you describe in looking at the Indus civilization.
Yes, the five cities I mentioned are only the tip of the iceberg. Of course, most people did not live in the large cities. Most people lived out in the countryside. This was a very strongly agricultural society, as was Mesopotamia and Egypt. You know, your average person was a farmer. And so most people lived in villages and smaller towns that were scattered all over the countryside, of which there are thousands, uncounted thousands. Many have been documented or at least surveyed in archaeological parlance. Most have not been dug. So we really don't know yet much about how the average person lived at that time. But archaeologists are starting to turn to these smaller sites to see if they can find clues as to who exactly the Indus people were, not just in the large cities where they were building grand structures and extremely well-planned city grids and standardizing weights, etc., but also in the smaller towns, many of which appear to have a lot of the same characteristics as the larger cities. That is, they're very orderly, they're well-planned, they have good sewage systems. So it seems that there was a real diffusion of this technology across this vast area that stretches from the Arabian Sea up to the Himalaya. So there's so much more that has yet to be discovered. We're getting the first real glimpse of the complexity, the diversity of the Indus civilization, and archaeologists are only now beginning to apply some of these new techniques, and the Indians and Pakistanis hopefully will begin working more closely together. And I think if this happens, we will get a much fuller picture of what was clearly the largest and possibly the most important of the first early human civilization.
Well, Andrew Lawler, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Science News writer Andrew Lawler reports on the ancient Indus civilization. You can read his article in this week's Science.
This is Nancy Goff, editor of Science Signaling. We are now accepting original research submissions for publication starting September 2008. The journal formerly known as Science's SDKE is devoted to the topic of cellular signal transduction. To learn more, go to www.sciencesignaling.org.
Finally today, David Grimm, editor of Science's free online daily news site, Science Now, joins us to talk about the latest science stories. Hi, David.
Hey, Rob.
So what stories do you have for us today?
Well, Rob, we're going to talk about a study that challenges the idea that sitting on a couch all day makes you fat, how researchers are using cell phones to track human movement, and finally, how astronomers have found a very small extrasolar planet and why that's a good thing.
Let's start with why sitting on a couch is not making you fat. That doesn't gel very well with the idea of being a couch potato.
Right. And the idea has been among people that study obesity that there's two factors contributing to the obesity epidemic that's been seen over the past decade or couple decades, where people, especially in Western countries, have been getting a lot fatter than they were in the past. And the two ideas are that people are eating more and that they're also sitting around more than our predecessors did. And so a group of researchers decided to see if there was any truth to this notion that because we've become more sedentary, that we've also become heavier.
How did they measure sedentariness?
Well, Rob, they used a technique called the doubly labeled water method. And what this is it's water molecules that have been modified so that the hydrogen or the oxygen atoms contain a few more neutrons than normal. And that allows the researchers to distinguish these water molecules from normal water molecules. And when people drink this water, they metabolize it, they use the oxygen, and the researchers are able to measure, by looking at people's urine, their rate of metabolism.
And so did they look at data from people all over the world?
Well, they looked at a few studies. They looked at 20 years worth of data in a group of people, about 350 people from the Netherlands, who had been studied using this doubly labeled water method, not for obesity, but for other reasons. And so the researchers just happened to have the data for this. And they compared it to other similar studies that had been done in the U.S. and in developing countries. And what they found is, no matter which countries they looked at or which time periods they looked at, people were burning about the same number of calories on average.
Suggesting that their metabolism was about the same.
Right. And so what that means is that what really seems to be behind the recent obesity epidemic is not a bunch of people sitting around longer than their parents and their grandparents did, but that people are really just eating more food today than previous generations did.
Any other possible explanations or concerns about the data over all these various time periods?
Well, experts think it's a provocative study. But there is the concern that because they're comparing all these different studies across countries and across time periods, studies that were done potentially differently in different places and at different times, that it's hard to aggregate all the data and make one solid conclusion from it. So that's something that the researchers may need to address if they carry this work forward.
Well, from tracking people around the world sitting around to tracking people moving around the world. What's going on in this cell phone study?
Well, Rob, scientists are interested in learning more about how people move about the globe. And it's important to learn things like this. For instance, for researchers studying disease, they wanted to see how flu might be spread or if there's an outbreak of some disease, how it might be transmitted globally. And to answer that, we really need to know what are the patterns that humans use to move around.
So they use cell phone data?
Right. And that's because every time you text message or make a call on a cell phone, it's relayed through a cell phone tower. And because of how these cell phone towers are placed, they give a good indication of approximately where a person was when he or she made a call or sent a text message. So a team of researchers monitored 100,000 cell phone users for 6 months and tracked their movement patterns based on the cell phone towers that were being used for their calls. And what the researchers found is that most people stuck to a confined area. They rarely left town. There was a smaller group of people that traveled extensively. But the interesting thing the researchers found was that when they had all of these people rank their favorite spots to hang out, whether it was work or the gym or the theater, everybody spent approximately the same amount of time at their favorite spot. So, Rob, if your, say, third favorite spot to hang out was the movie theater and my third favorite spot to hang out was the gym, then if they compared our cell phone patterns, we spent approximately the same amount of time at our third favorite spots. And it suggests that people have overall very similar patterns of travel. That may seem obvious, and a lot of this stuff may seem intuitive, But this is really the first solid data that really encapsulates what we already thought. It actually provides hard data for these movement patterns.
That there's something fundamental about the way we move about.
Exactly.
Is it likely that people would continue to move about in the same way, say, if there were an epidemic?
Well, that's a good question. And really, the next step is figuring out, okay, now that we know people have overall similar movement patterns, what's behind these patterns? Why do people adopt the patterns that they do? And that's important for studying something like a catastrophic event. So if there is some sort of epidemic, researchers might better be able to track it.
Well, from tracking people using this global network of cell phone towers to what it takes to find extrasolar planets, global networks of telescopes. Tell us about this new smaller planet.
Well, Rob, as you may know, astronomers have already found hundreds of planets outside of our solar system. I think it's actually more than 300 so far. But most of these planets don't look anything like Earth. They tend to be huge, thousands of times larger than Earth, and even many times the mass of Jupiter. And because they're so big, they tend to resemble Jupiter. They're these large gas giants that would be very unlikely for supporting life. And obviously the Holy Grail is finding a planet a lot like Earth that's out there that might support life. And so when astronomers are looking for these extrasolar planets, smaller is better.
Now, these smaller planets must be harder to find. Is there some new technique astronomers use to find this smaller planet?
Well, it's not a new technique, but it is being more widely used. The technique is called microlensing. So using this technique, they were able to find this very small planet out there. And by very small, the planet's about 3 times the mass of Earth, which is still big, but it's a lot smaller than a lot of these other Jupiter-size or bigger than Jupiter-size extrasolar planets that astronomers have been finding.
What about the star it's rotating around?
Well, what's also interesting is that the star it's rotating around is a very small star. It's actually only about 6% the mass of our own sun. And this planet is actually closer to its star than Earth is to the sun. Now, initially, you might think, well, that means the planet has got to be warmer than Earth is. But because its star is so small, it's actually a lot colder than Earth is. It's more likely to resemble a Neptune than an Earth. So it's a cold planet and probably has a lot of ice and gas on it. So it's probably not the ideal place for life to be. But what's exciting about this discovery is that it shows that astronomers are starting to locate these very small planets out there. And with a bit of luck, they may eventually find a planet that looks a whole lot more like Earth.
Okay, well, thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Rob.
So what other stories are you looking into for Science Now?
Well, Rob, we're looking into a story about massive earthquakes or ice quakes in Antarctica, which up until now have never been detected. We're delving into the mysteries of Saturn's F ring. And finally, we're going to look at the brain chemistry behind the Golden Rule. So be sure to check out the site.
David Grimm is the editor of Science Now, the free online daily news site of science. You can check out the latest science stories at sciencenow.sciencemag.org. And that wraps up the June 6, 2008 Science Podcast. If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. The show is a production of Science Magazine and of AAAS, the Science Society. The content is provided by the news and editorial staff of Science, and Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Robert Frederick. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, thanks for joining us.